You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. In this podcast, Dr. Frank Friedman discusses Piedmont Virginia Community College, its mission, enrollment, curriculum, student outcomes, facilities, and funding. Frank Friedman serves as president of Piedmont Virginia Community College. As president, he provides leadership and management for an institution of 5,500 students, full-time faculty and staff, and a budget of over $24 million. Dr. Friedman has served as a faculty member and an administrator in community colleges since 1977. Prior to becoming president of PVCC in 1999, he served as executive vice president of Austin Community College in Texas. He has experience as a chief academic officer, chief student services officer, director of institutional research and planning, and as a faculty member in psychology and education. Dr. Friedman has a doctorate in educational psychology and a master's degree in experimental psychology from Purdue University and a bachelor's degree in psychology from Muhlenberg College. Mr. Friedman spoke at the Wednesday, March 12, 2014 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV past president Sue Liberman. Our podcast is entitled The Community College, Access and Excellence. Here's Sue Liberman.
It is with great pleasure that I introduce Frank Friedman to you. Dr. Friedman has served as president of Piedmont Virginia College for 15 years. And as president, he provides leadership and management for an institution of 5,500 students, 150 full-time faculty and staff, and a budget of over $24 million. I'm going to read only some of his resume, vitae, whatever, and in the more immediate past, Dr. Friedman has served on National Higher Education Advisory Commissions with the American Association of Community Colleges and the College Board. He served 6 years as commissioner of the Commission on Colleges of the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools, and served 3 years as an elected Virginia representative to the 13-member Executive Council of the Commission. Among his accomplishments are being named to Phi Beta Kappa Scholar, recognition by Who's Who in American Education, and Who's Who among American teachers, and receiving the Community Service Award given by the Virginia Piedmont Technology Council in 2005. In Charlottesville, Dr. Friedman is on the board of directors of the Central Virginia Partnership for Economic Development, the Thomas Jefferson Area United Way, the Jefferson School Foundation, and the Entrepreneurial Village, and serves as first vice president of the Regional Chamber of Commerce, where he soon will become president. His wife, Sue, is president of the Alzheimer's Association of Central and Western Virginia, and they have one son, Alex, who's a 2009 graduate of UVA. On a more personal note, I've had the pleasure of getting to know Dr. Friedman as a Rotarian and also as a citizen of Charlottesville, involved in many community activities and issues not mentioned in his bio. I know him to be a concerned, passionate, and eloquent and involved person who always puts his heart and personal commitment into whatever issue he chooses to champion. And it's with great pleasure I introduce Frank Friedman.
Well, thank you, Sue. Whenever I have formal introductions, the only thoughts that go through my mind are, I wish my mother was here to hear that. She would just love that. It also scares me to death when, during the introduction, a person stops and says, and now let me speak on a personal note. And I think, oh no, what's coming? Especially from Sue. Well, thank you very much. I'm honored to be your speaker today. And I'm going to talk about community colleges in America, but mostly about our local community college, Piedmont Virginia Community College, where I've worked for the last 15 years. Let me start off by, let's get a show of hands. How many of you have ever taken a course at PVCC? Raise your hand. Now keep them up, okay? How many of you have had a relative, family member take a course? Get those hands up. How many of you have had an employee or coworker take courses at PVCC? All right. Yeah, I see you, Jim. If you look around, you'll see half, two-thirds of the hands of audience members up in the air. Anywhere I go and start out a talk like that, anywhere in Central Virginia where I go and start out a talk in that way, I'm going to see half to two-thirds of the hands go up. And that's what a community college is all about. It's all about educating the community. And it's wonderful to see all those hands go up as I start out. So most of you know something about PVCC. Maybe you know it from the perspective of a student or a parent. But let's find out how much you really know. Let's start that way. So you bring an educator to do a talk, guess what happens? You get a quiz. Sue, Madison, would you go ahead and hand out the quiz? That'll teach you to invite an educator. If you have a pencil or pen, please go ahead and answer the questions. If you do not, just kind of mentally answer the questions. No. I'm not going to collect these. You won't get any gold stars or A pluses. Now, if you were listening to Sue's introduction, some of the answers she gave away. Go ahead and see how you will do on this, and then we'll talk about it. Okay, let's see how well you did. This is very, very easy to score. The correct answer to every question is A. Now, I'm sure everybody here got 10 out of 10 correct. I'll talk a little bit about some of these during the next few minutes, but if you have any of these that I omit or you want me to talk about, I think there'll be plenty of time later for questions. So please ask those, especially if there's one where you're sure you were right and I'm wrong. So you can argue with me on that. What I want to do during the next few minutes is cover six topics. I'm going to talk about community colleges in America, just give you a little context. And then I'm going to talk about PVCC. I'm going to talk about mission, our enrollment, our curriculum, the outcomes for our students, our facilities, and our funding. Six things. And I might point out right now, Jim emailed me last week and said, are you going to use PowerPoint during your presentation? And I rarely do that because I'm always worried the technology will somehow have a glitch. Now, I know with Jim here it will not, but other places it does. But for those of you who are addicted to PowerPoint, right now you can imagine there's a screen behind me and there are six bullets that say mission, enrollment, curriculum, outcomes, facilities, and funding. And that way you'll get your share of PowerPoint today. Okay. America's community colleges. Let me read you two things to help set the context. More and more young people emerge from high school ready neither for college nor for work. This predicament becomes more acute as the knowledge base continues its rapid expansion. The number of traditional jobs shrink, and new jobs demand greater sophistication and preparation. Sounds right, doesn't it? Sounds like what we hear all the time as we move into the 21st century. The only problem was it was written 40 years ago. It was true then, it's true today. The golden age for community colleges was in the late 60s, early 70s. Community colleges were popping up all over the country. Whole systems of community colleges were being built. In Virginia, it started in 1966, and the 23 public community colleges we have in Virginia all opened between 66 and 72. It was a movement. It was a real movement in American higher education. And that gives rise to the next quote I want to read you. And this is from our former Secretary of Education, John Gardner. And he said, "The greatest American educational invention of the 19th century was the land-grant college. The greatest American educational invention of the 20th century is the two-year community college." And I certainly believe that. In our country today, there are about 1,100 community colleges. They enroll about 7.5 million students in credit courses and another 5 million students in non-credit courses. And what that means is, of all the students in higher education in our country, right around half go to community colleges, something that's often overlooked. In Virginia, as I said, there are 23 public community colleges. Last semester, they enrolled about 180,000 credit students. And again, something I'll bet you didn't know, there are more students in Virginia in community colleges than in all of our four-year colleges and universities put together. We are the largest segment of higher education in Virginia. So let me get into who we are, what we are, and why that is. Let me start with mission. I hate mission statements, don't you? I read those things, whether it's for a college or a company, and I read those things and I go, what? You know. So there are four parts of our mission that I want to emphasize. And if you understand these four parts, you'll have a pretty good idea of what makes a community college unique. So the first part of our mission, I want to stress, is access. We believe that a post-secondary education should be available to everyone. Keyword, everyone. Now, notice the way I said that. I said post-secondary education. You read a lot nowadays, these articles, that college isn't for everyone. Have you seen those articles? And then it goes on to say, but technical training is. Well, technical training is post-high school. It's post-secondary, and that's what we do in part. So when I say post-secondary is for everyone, I mean not just preparation for a bachelor's degree, but preparation for jobs that are going to require skills that go well beyond what any high school can teach an individual by the time they get out of high school. If you really believe post-secondary education's for everyone, just think of how you've got to organize that institution. You've got to make the education convenient. You can't just have day classes, can you? Because there are a lot of people who work during the day. So you got to have day classes, night classes, weekend classes. And nowadays, you have to offer classes over the internet because people who need post-secondary education often have to fit it in around all the other things going on in their life. And if they can take it at home whenever they have free time by taking the course over the internet, you're making that education accessible. So community colleges excel in making education accessible. Now, go back to the 1960s and 1970s when community colleges were founded on this belief in access. Think about what else was going on in higher education in our country. We still had colleges and universities who did not allow in African Americans. Community colleges said, no, everyone. We had colleges and universities who didn't allow women. And community colleges said, no, everyone. It's for the benefit of the person. It's also for the benefit of society. We're going to need every individual to be a productive, employed individual if our economy is going to grow as we need to. And now we say in a global economy. We didn't use that term back then, but that's really what we meant. So this notion of access and everyone getting into college was totally radical 50 years ago. Today it's pretty mainstream. It also means that age is not an issue. You know, when you think of community college, or when you think of college student, if you shut your eyes and you picture college student, you probably picture an 18, 19, 20-year-old kid at college. Well, that's not the case anymore. College students come in all shapes and sizes and ages, and community colleges believed right from the start in lifelong learning. We were the first to really get out there and say, people are going to have to learn throughout their life to keep up with the rapidly changing knowledge in our world, and especially technology. And we're going to see people coming back to college in their 20s, in their 30s, in their 50s, in their 70s. And that's exactly what we see at community colleges. Age is not a barrier. You come to one of our classes, you're going to have an 18-year-old sitting next to a 40-year-old, sitting next to a 30-year-old, you name it. And that's part of what access is all about. It also means that we take people no matter what their educational background. You know, if you believe everyone's going to need this, you can't just say, well, we're only going to take the best students. If you don't have all A's and B's in high school, forget it. No, we mean everyone. We're what's called an open door institution. And what that means is if you have a high school degree, if you have a GED, or even if you don't have either of them, but you're over 18 and you can prove to us you're ready for college by taking a couple placement tests, you're in. We're not selective in our admissions policy because we believe in access. All right, next step. Oh, one more point on access. If you really want everyone to be able to get an education, you better keep it as inexpensive as possible. Now, we're struggling with that. But our tuition rate, as you saw in your quiz, we're about one-third the cost of the next least expensive option that someone in Virginia has. In other words, for us, full year, fall and spring, full-time student, about $4,000. JMU is probably about $9,000 right now on tuition and fees. UVA, I think, is about $12,000. So comparatively, we are affordable. Now, our tuition has been going up, and that's an issue we've got to deal with. But comparatively, we're still very affordable. The second part of our mission is student success. We don't just want to take them in. We want our students to succeed. We always talk about we're not there to weed out the educational winners from the educational losers. We're dedicated to students succeeding. And what that means is if you're taking in students who might have a less than stellar academic background, or you're taking in students who might have been out of school for the last 20 or 30 years, you better build in all sorts of support. You better build in counseling, advising, career counseling. You better build in tutoring, a reading center, a writing center, a math center, tutoring in every subject we offer, all for free. And that's how we build the institution. It is built around those kind of supportive services because, again, if you take that kind of student and you want them to succeed, you better build your institution around it. Third part of our mission is teaching. We're a teaching institution. We are not a research institution like the university. Our faculty are there to teach. They're there to interact with students. All of them have to be advisors to students. Many of them sponsor clubs and so forth. Engagement with students is what they're all about. But we're a teaching institution. We keep classes small. You are probably bigger than 98% of our classes. We only have a handful of classes that we allow to go over 40 students. And those are in classes where the students immediately break into either clinical settings for our nursing courses or labs for our anatomy and physiology. Other than nursing and anatomy and physiology, we don't have a single class over 40. We want interaction. between faculty and students. And you don't get that when you have 300-seat lecture halls. I've taught in that environment. I couldn't even see the back row, let alone interact with them. That's not our style. Also, our faculty teach. Typical teaching load is 15 credit hours, which for most of our faculty breaks down to 5 3-credit courses a semester. Typical university faculty load 1, 2, maximum of 3 courses a semester. Our faculty, it's 5. We're a teaching institution. Faculty teach a lot. And when we hire them, I tell them, if you don't want to spend your life teaching, don't take the job here, because that's what you're going to do. Last part of our mission, the fourth element, community. Community is our middle name as a community college. We are here to support the educational needs of our community. We are especially to link in with the workforce needs of our community and the economic development needs of our community. That's why, it is, as when Sue introduced me, yes, I'm on the Central Virginia Economic Development Organization. I'm on that board, have been for years, and now I'm the chair of the Chamber of Commerce Board. These are ways to connect our community college with our community, especially looking at what kind of workers will our community need, our businesses need in order to be productive. And it's not just an academic exercise. We try to bring that information in and then form the programs that are unique or are needed by our local community. I'll give you just 2 quick examples of that. Piedmont has programs in viticulture and enology, winemaking. Now, why do we do that? Because that was a growing, no pun intended, part of the economy of Albemarle County and Central Virginia. And those folks who were starting up those vineyards and wineries came to us, which is what they should do, and said, we're going to need workers. And this is what they're going to need to be trained to do. These are the skills they're going to have. Can you guys teach it? And the answer is, yeah, we can. And we put together a curriculum, and we've had over 400 students go through that program. And a number of the wineries and vineyards you probably visit have actually been started by graduates of our program. I think we now number about 10 that have been started by folks who have graduated from our program. A second example, real quickly, when the Defense Intelligence Agency was moving all those folks from Northern Virginia down to Rivanna Station up on 29, just north of here, we looked at that and said, hey, are you going to need more folks to work there than you're bringing? And the answer was yes. Even though they were bringing hundreds, they were going to have several hundred openings. And we sat down with them, and we developed a curriculum to prepare people to be intelligence analysts. The folks who read all those photos that the satellites take and interpret them and so forth. So we started a very unique program to prepare local people for those local jobs. And the graduates of that program are making phenomenal salaries, either working for the government or for contractors who do that work for the government. Unique programs, you wouldn't start those in Southwest Virginia, but you would start them here because we are community-based, and that's what we try to support. And a good community college is locally based and has some unique aspects based on the local needs. All right, so that's, if you understand those 4 things, you understand how we're different. Access, student success, teaching, community. That's who we are. All right. Quick numbers, for those of you who like numbers, enrollment, we're about 5,600 back in the fall. We've been on a very rapid growth curve. If you go back to 2006, our enrollment was 4,100. So we've gone from 4,100 to 5,600, like a 30% increase in a half dozen years or so. A lot of that fueled by the recession. You know, it's interesting. When a recession hits, think about it. Some people get laid off, or they're afraid they're going to get laid off, or they go from full-time back to part-time, or they get worried, you know, is my job going to exist in a year or two? So what do Americans do when that happens? They go back to school. And where do you go back to school if you're in your 20s, 30s, 40s, or 50s? You go to an American community college. So our enrollment skyrocketed during the recession. We're now plateauing, which is not unexpected. That's what should happen as we come out of this recession and people do get their jobs back. We're no longer in that rapid growth mode. And tell you the truth, that's good. It's good to see people getting their jobs back. When you look at our students, I think you already have an idea, and the quiz highlighted some of this. 75% of our students are part-time. Only 25% take 12 credits or more in a semester. That's what full-time means. And most of them are the young kids, the kids who come to us right out of high school. We get about 500 a year who come to us right after high school graduation from all over our region. And they're the ones who tend to be mostly full-time. The rest of our students fit college in around their life. 80% of our students work while going to college. 80%. And that includes the young kids. They're all, for the young kids, a lot of times it's 20 or 30 hour a week jobs. For the older students, so many of them are married, have families, full-time jobs, and then they're adding courses towards new skills or a new career. About 40%, 35 to 40% of our students are over the age of 25. So, yeah, majority are under 25, but not by much. 1,200 of our students don't even come to campus. They're in high schools. We have a program called dual enrollment. In a dual enrollment program, students in high school in 11th and 12th grade who are academically capable, and they have to demonstrate that to us by taking some tests, we deliver our courses in the high school. You know, think about it. When you were in 11th or 12th grade, you probably took American history. Well, guess what? We teach American history at the college. And I'll talk about me. I took American history in high school, and then I took American history again in college. It was a requirement. Well, dual enrollment says, let's take the college course with a college-qualified teacher, let's teach it in the high school, and let's count it both, that's the dual part, both for high school credit and college credit. Neat idea, huh? It's free, which makes it even a neater idea. We have a wonderful way of working this out with the school systems. The kids and their parents pay nothing. And they earn college credits that are applicable at PVCC or anywhere. These credits are going to transfer. They're going to count wherever they go. My son, Madison, was asking me how my son's doing. He graduated from Albemarle High School. He had 12 dual enrollment credits from PVCC. He went straight from Albemarle to UVA. All 12 credits counted. He had almost a semester knocked out at UVA for free. And as a parent, I loved it. It's a good program. Looking at our students, about 23% are minority, and about 50% are on financial aid. That tells you something, right? Even though our tuition is as low as it is compared to others, 50% are on financial aid. And when you hear our congressmen, our senators, or any of them in Washington talking about Pell Grants and the need to cut back on Pell Grants, just think of those 50% who couldn't be in college without a Pell Grant and how important that is to their development as an individual and our development as a community in getting college graduates to be a part of our community. Pell Grant is the single largest source of financial aid for our students. All right, I better speed up and move along. So what do they come to us for? Half of the students who come to us are using us as a stepping stone to a bachelor's degree. We offer what we call our transfer programs, and they're your basic first 2 years of just about any degree you would get at UVA, William & Mary, JMU, Virginia State, wherever. We coordinate it with those universities, and we have what's called guaranteed admission agreements. This is an agreement with between us and the university that says, okay, if a student goes to Piedmont and graduates, you got to earn your degree, and takes the transfer curriculum that the college specifies and earns a certain grade point average, which is defined by the university. If they do that and then they apply to us, they are guaranteed admission as a junior. Nice deal, right? At UVA, for instance, you must have a 3.4 GPA at PVCC to get that guarantee. William & Mary, it's 3.6. Some of the other institutions, it's 3.0, 2.5. And the less selective ones, it's even just a 2.0. But think about it. If you can come to PVCC for 2 years, live at home, your tuition and fees is $4,000. So $4,000 for 2 years, as opposed to going to a university, living in the dorms, and paying maybe $18,000 or $20,000 a year. Look at how much you save. If you earn those grades and graduate, you transfer in as a junior, you take your last 2 years at the university, you get that wonderful diploma to hang on the wall, and guess what? It says UVA or Virginia Tech. It doesn't have a little, you know, footnote that says, but you went to a community college for 2 years. It's a Virginia Tech degree or UVA degree, and your family has saved probably $25,000 along the way. It's a heck of a deal and has fueled part of our growth. About 35% of our students have no interest in getting a bachelor's degree right away. They're preparing for a job. They need a job, want a job, and their whole goal is to qualify for a better job. A huge number of those at PVCC are in healthcare programs. As you know, with UVA Health Center, with Martha Jefferson, those places have been hiring straight through the recession. We always hear about nursing shortages, but there are shortages of people who do sonography, people who do radiography. There's shortages of certified nurse assistants, LPNs, you name it, paramedics. And we have programs in all of those fields and more that prepare individuals for those jobs. And most of those folks, I mean, they're gobbled up like that. Many of them are offered jobs before they even graduate. We're graduating now about 200 a year in healthcare programs alone, and most of them are gobbled up here in town. Because of that, I might say, the UVA Health System and Martha Jefferson are extremely generous to us. Almost every one of those programs I mentioned gets financial support from one or the other or both of the hospitals. And as Leonard Sandridge said to me a long time ago, and many of you know, have known Leonard over the years, he said, hey, Frank, it's not because we like you. It's just good business. If we have to go recruit nurses in the Philippines, it costs us $5,000 for every nurse we recruit. I'd rather give you the money. You graduate them. We know they're well prepared, and we know they'll stay in this community because they have roots here. So Leonard, the wonderful business person, gave me a lesson in why UVA gives us funding for those programs. And about 15% of our students have neither of those interests. They're just there for personal interest. Taking a course they wanted to take. They're taking art. They're taking ceramics. I took CPR there to learn CPR. So about 15% of our students are just kind of dropping in, picking up whatever they're interested in, and then moving on. All right, outcomes. Being cheap is nice, but it's no good unless you get a good education, and a good education leads to good outcomes. So let me talk about what happens to our students after they leave us. We transfer about 600 students a year to colleges all over the country. About two-thirds are in-state, about a third out-of-state. When we look at those who go out-of-state, we have students who have gone to MIT, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford, BYU, on and on and on. Some of the elite institutions throughout the United States. About 120 a year or so are transferring from us to the University of Virginia. That makes us the largest supplier of transfers to the university of anywhere in the country, and we're very proud of that. Our students who go to the university, we've done joint research with UVA to follow up and ask the question, so how do they do? And we're very pleased that they do great. Graduation rate for our transfers to UVA is about 90%, which is just about what their graduation rate is for their freshmen. And they graduate with a grade point average of 3.16, which is exactly equal to the average graduation rate for UVA freshmen. What it says to us is they're prepared, they do well, and that's the key outcome there. An interesting fact, the 600 I counted are strictly transfers, meaning they came to us first, earned a bag of credits or graduated, and then left us. There's a whole other group that transfers. All those high school kids I told you about, last year 435 high school kids took dual enrollment from us and then went straight to a four-year school. They didn't come to us in between. We helped them, though, prepare for that four-year college. And most four-year schools now look extremely favorably on kids who have taken college-level courses while in high school. It's something that helps you qualify for really selective institutions. So we think we're doing a service there. All totaled, if you look at all of our students in 2011, and then the next year you say, how many of them were in a four-year college the next year? The answer is 1,558. Now, we don't call them all transfers because some of them, they swirl around. They start at a university, they come to us, then they go back to a university, then they come back to us, and then they go again. So we don't count them as transfers, but over 1,500 were with us 1 year and at a four-year college or university the next. We think that's a good outcome. On the employment side, we do follow-ups with our graduates. In a typical year, 85%, maybe a little bit more, end up with a job in a field directly related to the degree that they got from us. Many in healthcare, but many in other fields, electronics. Now we have culinary arts. We just started that program. Information technology, computer programming, on and on and on. We have many that prepare people immediately for work. All right, let me just hit two more things and then open it up to you. Facilities. If you've never been on our campus, it's a lovely campus across from Monticello on Route 20. We have four buildings on campus. We have our old original 1972 building, which is really the centerpiece of the campus. But then we have a beautiful humanities building with a 500-seat theater. And we have a brand new, well, we call it brand new. It's 4 years old now, but science building, which we're very proud of. We also own now what used to be the Monticello Visitor Center. You probably know that building down at the bottom of our hill, right off of Route 20. You used to start your tour of Monticello there with the film and the exhibits. When Monticello built their own wonderful visitor center, that building was actually owned by the city and county jointly. And I immediately went to both of them and said, what are you going to do with that building? And 10 years later, and that's about how long it took, it became ours. And that serves as our workforce center. That's where we do all of our training for businesses that come to us and say, I got a group of employees, they need to learn X, can you do that? And we use that building as the housing for those kinds of courses, symposia, workshops, seminars, that kind of thing. The last thing I'll touch on is funding. Somebody asked me, are you going to stand up like all presidents and tell us that you have all the money you need? And I said, yes, of course. I'm not much of a whiner. I've always gone by the idea, you know, you play the hand you're dealt. I like to play cards. I like to play poker. You play the hand you're dealt. And then you do the best you can. Here's the data. In 2006, when we had 4,100 students a semester, the state was giving us $9 million. Today, with 5,600 students a semester, the state is giving us $7.2 million. It has gone down 20%. Enrollment up 30%, funding down 20%. That's the truth. If you listen to politicians, you never know how they're going to describe this, but that's the truth. That's how the state funding has gone. It costs us, just to do what we do, about $6,000 per full-time equivalent student. Back in 2006, the state was giving us, in that $9 million I said, about $4,000 per full-time equivalent student. So our tuition was about $2,000 per full-time equivalent student. That's how we got our $6,000, which is what we really need to do our job. Now, that $7.2 million, that's $2,400 per full-time equivalent student. So guess what our tuition is? It's about $4,000. We've got to bring that number up to that $6,000, $6,200 or so, or else we're going to be laying people off, eliminating programs, cutting services. This is a no-frills budget. Trust me, we're a no-frills institution. But we've got to have $6,000 to $6,400 just to keep where we are. So when the state takes money away, our tuition's gone up. We're not happy about that because, as I said when I talked about access, we need to stay as accessible as possible. But what good is access if you can't deliver quality and you can't deliver value and you start turning students away because you don't have the programs they need or want? That would be the future if we didn't raise the tuition as we did. And whereas it's regrettable, it's also necessary. What that means to me in playing the hand I'm dealt, our philosophy is the only way we can do anything new on campus is to go raise the money. The state money and tuition money keeps us level at what we did last year. But like this year, we started a culinary arts program down at the Jefferson School in downtown Charlottesville. The kitchen equipment costs $465,000. Yeah, it's a heck of a kitchen, isn't it? But that's what it takes to educate 20 people at a time with a fully equipped kitchen. So $465,000, I can't take that from tuition or from state funding. So we have our own foundation that does our fundraising. And, I mean, let's face it, we're no UVA. We're not raising billions of dollars. But we raise between $1 and $2 million a year. And that enables us to do the new things, the special things that go above and beyond where we were and enable us to continue to meet the needs of the community. So our foundation has become more and more important to us. 2 years ago, we opened up a center in Greene County. You might have seen that in the media. We opened up a beautiful facility in Stanardsville. The county gave us the space for free, but it was unfinished space. Well, the renovation cost about $750,000. But our deal with the county was, when I raise the money, we'll renovate, we'll open. And fortunately, the people of Greene County stepped up, and we raised about $1.2 million, actually. So we were able to renovate the space and then also have some operating funds to, you know, to help with the costs after we opened up. That's pretty much the life we live right now. And I always joke with people, when I was hired as president in 1999, there wasn't a single question about could I raise money. Back then, it wasn't something community college presidents were expected to do. Now, when I chair committees hiring other community college presidents in Virginia, the first question we ask, what's your experience raising money? Because otherwise, the college is just going to be stuck and unable to really expand. Let me close with a positive story since I hit the funding negatively. Starting in the year 2000, a special national award was developed for community college students. It was developed by our parent organization, the American Association of Community Colleges, along with Phi Theta Kappa, which is the two-year college equivalent of Phi Beta Kappa, the National Honor Society. And then also USA Today newspaper and Coca-Cola. And what this was a competition among all the community college students in the country on scholarship, leadership, and service. Those were the criteria they would be evaluated on. And the outstanding community college student in each state would be recognized each year. It started in 2000, so it was called the New Century Scholar. The very first one in Virginia in 2000 was from Piedmont Virginia Community College. And in the 13 years that has been awarded, now remember, we're one of 23 community colleges. So we should come around to win this award once every 23 years if it just rotated. In 13 years, a PVCC student has won this award six times. Pretty good, huh? That's what we try to do. That's what we hope to do. That's what we hope to provide for our students and for our community. And I thank you very much for listening diligently, and I would be glad to field questions as long as you want to keep me here. Thank you.
Funding. You talked about all the important things that your community college and other community colleges are doing these days. What is the Commonwealth of Virginia doing? They're reducing your funding, but are they treating community colleges preferentially compared to the 4 years, or about the same, or what's going on there?
What we've seen, the big drop in our funding, of course, occurred during the recession. And we're trapped here. Remember what I said, during recessions, our enrollments always go up. They have every recession. But during recessions, states have less and less money. So what do they immediately cut? Higher education. So every recession, we go through this. More students, less money. This one was the worst. It's the worst recession we've had probably since the Great Depression. And it was the worst for us in the community college world. The last couple of years, we're starting to pick it back up. But we're picking back up very, very slowly. We have gotten some new monies coming into higher education each of the last 2 years. And if the General Assembly ever settles on a budget this year, there's a small amount of money, new money for higher education, about $150 million. To answer your question, of that $150 million, which was proposed by Governor McDonnell, and the House and Senate, although they've tinkered with it and they've made minor changes, but the total amount hasn't changed much. It's about $150 million of new money for higher ed. $30 million of that is for community colleges. Now, we're happy to get new money, but $30 million out of $150 million is 20%. And yet we have 50% of the students. And too often this is what's happening in Virginia, that a governor and our delegates and senators, who are friends of mine, I mean, I'm not trying to be critical of any of them, they will tell you how pleased they are to be putting more money into higher ed. But by the time it trickles down to us, it's just a trickle and is not overcoming the problems that we've experienced due to the funding gaps the last few years.
Given that funding is such a big issue for you, are you able to provide scholarships for low-income students?
Absolutely. The question was about scholarships. As I said, about half our students are on some sort of financial aid. The biggest source of financial aid is federal government, Pell Grants. The state gives us some money for financial aid, but it's fairly small. Our foundation, though, is now providing about $250,000 a year out of our private fundraising for scholarships. So that $250,000 a year probably covers 100 students or so, because some of the scholarships are for part-time and half-time and so forth. So about 100 of our students are getting scholarships funded, well, by people like you, by people who want to give back, who care about education. Many of our businesses in our community sponsor scholarships. And that's a key ongoing priority for our foundation, to raise money for scholarships to help our students afford their higher education. And each year we have either a lunch or a dinner where we bring the donor and the student who received the scholarship together and have a meal together and a program and all. And it's just wonderful to see, you know, the donor connect with that student, and the students are always so grateful, and they have such amazing stories. I mean, the student getting your scholarship could be a ex-military, a parent with three kids who's taking classes at night towards a nursing degree. I mean, what an incredible story, and to know you're helping make that possible. And it's just a great evening to see those folks together.
What do you think is the future of the, as a person who served on the KTAC board for 7 years while I was on the school board, what do you think is the future of the KTAC and PVCC cooperation? There already is some, but...
You might have been reading in the media, it's been covered a lot, KTAC, our Charlottesville Albemarle Technical Education Center, is undergoing a strategic plan. And they've hired a consulting group to lead that process, and that's been going on for better part of a year, I guess. And I'm very pleased with what's coming out of that strategic planning process at KTAC, and I've been involved a good deal from the start. KTAC and PVCC right now work together pretty closely. We try to make it as seamless as possible for students coming out of the KTAC programs to come to PVCC and continue their education. Remember what I said at the start. We believe everyone needs a post-secondary education. You know, just an example. KTAC has an automotive program. You know, if you graduate high school and you've gone through that automotive program, you think you can become an automotive technician for Toyota or General Motors or Ford? There's no way. If that's where your education stopped, you'll work at Jiffy Lube. You'll change oil and do, you know, those kinds of things for 10 or 12 bucks an hour, and that's it. But if you continue on and earn an associate degree from a program that is linked with one of the major manufacturers, you're going to start at $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 as an automotive tech. Now, we don't offer that program. We don't have a facility for it. But J. Sargent Reynolds Community College in Richmond does, and we refer those students to J. Sarge. We want them to go on and get that associate degree in automotive tech and earn that kind of money. We work very closely with KTAC to help their students continue their education, either with us or wherever is best for them. But what this new strategic plan is recommending is even a closer alliance between KTAC and PVCC. What this is basically suggesting, and I strongly support it, is for us to say, well, let me use culinary arts as an example. KTAC has a culinary arts program. PVCC has a culinary arts program. Now, their culinary arts grads can come into our program, and we give them credit for what they've learned previously. It's not like they have to start all over. But what this strategic plan says is, wait a minute. Let's just develop one culinary arts program where year one and two is at KTAC and year three and four is at PVCC. Let's build the curriculum in a totally seamless manner. Let's have no overlaps. Let's make it so that even though you're two different institutions, it works like you're one. And let's do that in nursing, and let's do that in radiography. Let's do that in all of the fields that our local employers tell us they need employees. To me, it's a wonderful idea. It's the way we should do it. And I've been before the KTAC board advocating for this. The decision will be theirs, obviously, not mine. But we are strongly supportive. We think it'll be good for the kids, and it will be really good for the employers and our community.
A question on forgetting the...
Where are we? Oh, Francis, I thought you were throwing your voice over here.
I understand the revenue side is a problem. But help us understand, during this period of declining state revenues per full-time equivalent student, what has your cost to educate full-time equivalent students done?
Our cost to educate has stayed fairly constant, and that's because what we've done is each time we lose dollars from the state, we make it up with increases in tuition. There's a lot of talk, oh, you can cut fat. You can cut out those useless administrators, cut out this, cut out that. I would invite any of you to come and spend some time with me or spend some time at PVCC. If you can find fat to cut, let me know. We're lean. As an example, we have 5,500 students. Do you know how many full-time faculty we have? We have about 75. That's all. We use about 200 part-time faculty or adjunct faculty every semester. Why? That's how we save money. Just pure and simple. I'd much rather have more full-time faculty. But put yourself in my position. Access. We turn nobody away. We're open to everybody. It would be a sin to say to students, sorry, we don't have any more room for you. Because access is what we're founded on. So we're not going to turn students away. We're going to take them all in. But we've only got 75 faculty teaching a certain number of courses. And we're dedicated to small sections. So we're not going to put 100 or 200 or 300 in a class. So how do we serve all those students? We hire adjunct faculty. They get paid on a per course basis about half of what full-time faculty get paid. So we stretch our dollars in order to keep students getting educated. We're blessed to be in Charlottesville where there is a supply of well-qualified, well-educated individuals to teach our courses. We're not cutting back on quality. Those folks are supervised, they're trained, evaluated. We don't think we're cutting back on quality, but we're making access available at an incredibly low cost. Now, the other way to limit cost would be if we started putting in 300 or 400 seat lectures. But we think our students would fall by the wayside. They couldn't handle that kind of educational environment. And so we'd take them in, but we'd watch them flunk. And that would violate our student success mission. Being a college president isn't that hard, to tell you the truth. These are the things that I consider as we have to make decisions. And then hopefully we make the decisions that are true to our mission, live within our funding, play the hand we're dealt, but continue to provide access and quality to our students.
Mr. President.
Yes, sir.
You have given a very excellent talk. I'm totally impressed. But I remember at one time Edgar Shannon, who former president of the University of Virginia, said that students who came from Piedmont, compared with the students at the University of Virginia, did better than the university students who were already there. I don't know whether you ever heard that remark or not.
I would never argue with a university president.
I have a question on your culinary school. For years, we have been associated with K-Tech and providing culinary wonderful lunches for us. We are having a very difficult time with K-Tech getting them to be able to come to the center. Does your program offer this type of catering out to the community, to the senior center, or you get maybe 50 or so meals?
Right now, we are not. We're in our first year of the program, and therefore we only have first-year students. And as the faculty member has structured the program, he really didn't feel that that should be something that's built into the first year of the program. I'm meeting with the faculty member and the dean, I think it's next week, to talk about where do we go from here. And that will be one of the issues that we will discuss. We've had many requests for small-time catering jobs or even large-time catering jobs, and so far we've turned them all down. The issue is, this is a learning experience for students. They're learning to what they need to know to get jobs in this field. Many of the catering jobs, you have to be careful that they don't overwhelm their time, let's put it that way, because you end up doing the same thing over and over for the catering jobs, and that doesn't expand their knowledge base. So we've got to find a happy medium in terms of their time for new learning as well as production, which is what the catering really requires.
Well, a lot of times in the catering, it might be for a party for a private person.
Yes.
Our position is different. This is a community of seniors, and the interaction between the student and the senior gives them a lot of perspective that they may not get doing a private party. So I hope you will think about that.
We will. I won't make you any promises, but I will say that I'll make sure I bring that up when we meet.
What K-Tech did was our monthly luncheons. I think they didn't do them in the summertime, right? Just during the school year. And for instance, if it were March, it might have been a St. Patrick's Day. It wasn't, just maybe once a month.
Yeah, I understand.
And I have another question, please. What education qualifications for staff members, in addition to having a college degree, does PVC require?
For a staff member to work at PVCC? No,
yeah, I mean, people who work there, what degrees do they possess?
It all depends what kind of job you're talking about. For faculty, for teaching, they must have a master's degree or higher in the field they teach, or they must have a master's degree in any field but 18 graduate semester hours in the field they teach. That sounds like jargon, I know that, but it has specific meaning to us. And I'll just give you an example. Many of our wonderful teachers in elementary school, middle school, and high school have master's degrees in education. They might have a bachelor's degree in history and then a master's degree in education, and they teach history in the high school. They could not teach history for us. To teach college history, we believe they need to have a greater depth of learning in the field they're teaching. They must have 18 graduate semester hours specifically in history to accompany that master's degree in education. And this is not a knock on their ability. This is not saying they're not doing a great job in their teaching. But we have many cases where a teacher like that would like to teach one of our dual enrollment courses in the high school, and we cannot allow that. They do not meet our minimum criteria. What's interesting is, you hear a lot about advanced placement courses in the high school. That person can teach an advanced placement course. They do meet their criteria. Our criteria is higher. They don't meet ours.
Yes, I'm sure that you have been following the student loan debates. I know that Pell is a major source of funding, and thank goodness, but the economics of this are that the kids graduating have so much debt that in the long run they may have a lower standard of living.
Yeah.
Lower standard of living than other college graduates, but maybe higher than what they would have. So the question is there a reasonable trade-off between the debt that your students carry and the income that they can make as a result?
Now, you hit a very good point. The number of students taking out student loans at PVCC has grown tremendously the last 5 years. Now, you must understand, though, the loans they're going to take out for PVCC are going to be much, much smaller than a loan they're going to take out at Virginia Tech or a private school, for instance. You know, our students are mostly taking out loans of a couple thousand dollars, perhaps, in a year. Whereas students at universities, the average debt, if I read this right, students at the universities are now graduating with an average debt of between $25,000 and $30,000. It would be extremely rare for a student from us to have that kind of debt. The debt would be smaller. But it is still a problem and an issue, especially for those students who take out the loans but then drop out. You know, for our students who graduate, I'm going to go out on a limb and say the debt is probably not that big a problem, because our students who graduate are going on successfully to get jobs, and they are in a position to pay those loans back. And my wife and I both had student loans when we graduated, and we paid them off over 10 or 12 years or whatever. And I think our students are in a good position to do that. But the ones I worry about are the ones who take out those loans and then drop out, either due to academic difficulties or due to family situations or illness. You know, there's no forgiveness there. You just took out a loan of $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 or $8,000 or whatever, and you didn't get a degree. So you're still kicking around in the same low-paying job probably, and now you've got the debt on top of it. They're the ones I really worry about. And just as a quick aside, Senator Warner is going to be on our campus on Wednesday and meet with students. And this, I know, is one of the topics he wants to talk with them about as he tries to figure out what can Congress do in the future about the student loan issue.
Yes, I'm curious about the program content and the sourcing of the online courses that students take. I assume it's from various professors, but also other people provided, or
that for us, online courses are not a source of revenue. We do online courses due to our access mission. And, you know, again, if you live 45 minutes from our campus and you work all day and then you got to get over to campus for a 3-hour class at night, that might just be what says to you, oh, it's not worth it. I'm too tired. I'm not going to sign up for classes. It's too big a hassle. I got to drive 45 minutes each way. That could be the barrier that knocks you out of your education. But by making the courses available over the internet, we eliminate that drive time. If you've got kids, you can take the course after you put kids to bed. It's convenience that enables people to access their education. Last semester, I believe it's 1 out of every 5 students at PVCC takes at least 1 internet course a semester. So that's a little over 1,000. I think we were at 1,100 last semester who took at least 1 course on the internet that semester. About 10% of our students take all their courses on the internet. There are certain programs they can get the entire degree that way, and we're about 10% who are doing that. All of our internet courses are taught by our regular faculty. We do not contract out any of that. They are taught by our regular faculty. In almost every case, the faculty teaching the online course also teaches that course in a live version. Our online courses do not have more students in them than a face-to-face version of the same course. And that is because we expect an equal amount of interaction in that online course as you would have in a face-to-face course. Now, that interaction is chat rooms, discussion boards, emails. But if you load up a faculty member with 300 students, you think that person's going to respond to all those emails and chat boards? And that isn't going to happen. So we limit it to the same number of students, 30 or 40, whatever the cap is, as a face-to-face course. And we work, all of our internet teachers must be certified. We have a training program in internet instruction that not only goes over the technology, but the pedagogy. You know, we don't want internet courses to be like correspondence courses on a computer. The idea is not, okay, read what's on the computer, take a test, send it in. No, we have to have interaction. We have to have simulations built into the computer. We have to have projects built in. It's got to be an equivalent type of learning experience, just using a different methodology. You know, a lot of people have been fascinated with this MOOCs stuff, and my own board at a retreat last summer, you know, what's Piedmont going to do about MOOCs? And I said, we're not going to do them. Forget it. You know, in MOOCs right now, you get 50,000 people in a MOOC. You know how many complete the course? You know, like 5%, 10%, that's all. Everybody else drops out. Now, they're not paying for it, and many of them just signed up out of curiosity, but our success rate in internet courses is 75%. Which is the same as our face-to-face courses. We work very hard. We expect the same outcomes in the internet courses face-to-face. If we took money from students and only 10% ended up passing the course, shame on us. That's not what we're about. And MOOCs, many of the universities see it as a future moneymaker. We're not in it for the making the money. You know, maybe we should be. Maybe that's my fault. But we're in it to serve the students, so MOOCs don't really fit into our plans.
I think you already answered my question. The question is, you compare the internet courses to live courses, and it seems like you said that you expect the success to be the same in both.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
In many, I won't say all, but in many of the internet courses, the final exam is the same final exam that is used in the face-to-face version. So that way, you know the outcomes are going to be similar. You know, to get a passing grade, you've got to master the same set of knowledge and skills, whether it's face-to-face or online. And that's how we really patrol, if you will, the quality and outcomes of those courses.
Would the final exam also be online?
Pardon me?
Would the final exam also be online?
It's a yes and a no. In many cases, yes. In some of the courses, you must come to campus and take the final exam proctored. That varies depending on the course.
How could you be sure
that it's the student?
That it's the student taking the exam.
It's very simple. Students have to have a webcam.
Okay. Very good. I never thought.
Yeah. Students would have to have a webcam. And what's going to happen in the future, we're not there yet. In the future, you're going to have those bio, whatever the word is, on the computers where you put your thumb in and it recognizes you. That's going to happen in the future. So I think we'll get there to answer that question. We're not there yet, though.
Maybe I shouldn't ask this, but I'm wondering about the fundraising.
Yeah.
Whether you do any, and I've never heard of any. And
well, you will.
Compared to UVA, where we're constantly.
Just all you have to do is leave your name and email, and no, we have a. The PVCC Educational Foundation Board, which is our fundraising board. We have a very small development office. It's only three individuals. We are raising about $1 to $2 million a year for the last couple of years. That's been our average. But our approach to fundraising is money in, money out. We're not in the banking business. We're not trying to build up a large endowment. We're a state institution. We have confidence the state will continue to fund us, so we're not building up money in case the state bails out or something. We generally raise funds for a specific use and project, and that's how we go about it. The last general purpose campaign we did was about... I'm going to say about 6 years ago, we raised about $3.5 million in a general purpose campaign. Since then, we've concentrated on specific campaigns for specific reasons. We're probably not as aggressive at it as we should be. We're probably not as good at it as we'd like to be. Hopefully, we're getting better. But I you know, when I first came to town, Piedmont was trying desperately to finish off its first $1 million campaign. This was 1999. They'd been at it like 4 years, and they couldn't get over the $1 million hump. If you remember back then, UVA was trying to wrap up their first $1 billion campaign. And when I first met John Castine and we got to know each other, I would joke with him and say, it's only one letter difference, you know. With the UVA being here and their incredible ability to raise money, we're in a very different league. It's also important to know UVA employs more people in the development office than Piedmont employs in total. We're a different scale.
A fairly significant part of Governor McAuliffe's campaign was to go around to all 23 community colleges and to say how important they were to our economic future and to the future of the students that go there. Do you foresee his next budget?
Do you have a crystal ball?
Am I a dreamer? No. Do you foresee his being more aggressive in funding for community colleges in the next cycle?
Obviously, we're very hopeful. You're exactly right. Governor McAuliffe did make community colleges and workforce development one of the key planks, one of his key priorities as he campaigned. He was at Piedmont twice, I believe, during the campaign, and we got to know each other. We're very anxious to work with the governor. He will have his first budget introduction in 2 years. You know, next year being a short session, it'll just be amendments to the budget. But he will get his budget out in 2 years. And we are very hopeful that we can work with the governor and see some significant funding improvement. And if you have a crystal ball, I'd love to know the answer.
One final question, sir. In thinking of the financial difficulties in this day and age, what if you were to have your football scholarships?
Well, first we'd have to have a football team. if you don't mind, a quick story, though. In 1990, from 90 to 96, I was the academic vice president of Middle Georgia College, which is a two-year community college, but it's residential. It dates itself way back to the 1930s. It started as a private school, later became part of the University System of Georgia, and evolved into a two-year community college. But we had about 800 students in the dorms. And we had a very active athletic program. We had won national championships in baseball. And we had half dozen or so of our former players in the major leagues. We had good basketball program and so forth. And the president I worked for is a wonderful man, a great, great, great friend. He was a former football player. He was in love with football. And there were a number of donors and supporters in the community who wanted to start up a football program, and we did. And, a football program means you got to have 80 or so kids on the team, unlike a basketball team where you have 15. And you get into uniforms and scholarships and all of that. And, I'm the academic VP, and I'm just watching money move in the direction of supporting that football program. And the president and I to this day, he's a great friend, but that was one of the great disagreements we had, that I just saw the money going to support that instead of the things that I felt we needed to do academically. After he retired, and I had already moved on, about 5 years after he retired, they eliminated the football program.
I was wondering about applicants who don't pass the entrance exam. Are they given information by a counselor or someone about how to deal with that so that they can take the test again and pass it?
And let me clarify, it's not an entrance exam, because as an open-door institution, they're admitted. Everyone is admitted. What we do is we test their basic skills, reading, writing, and math. And it's a simple idea. You know, they're going to take college-level courses. But if their reading, writing, and math skills are not up to a college level, the chances are they're not going to pass. I liken it to, if you've got people who can't swim, you can throw them in the deep end of the pool, and some of them will splash around and they'll survive. But a lot of them are going to sink. And that's what would happen to our students. Some of them would splash around in reading and math courses, and due to their hard work, and maybe they'd get a tutor, they'd survive. But too many of them would sink, and they'd have spent money, they'd have failed, their confidence would be shattered, their interest in higher ed might be shattered. So what we require is, if you don't score high enough on those tests, you must take preparatory courses. We call them developmental. They do not carry college credit, so they don't move you towards graduation. You do have to pay for them, but you must complete those to elevate your skill level in order to then take the required college course. For many of those students, that's a tough road You know, could you guys pass algebra right now? Yeah, I couldn't either. You know, math is the biggest trouble. I was just saying that to somebody, or to Bob earlier. Math is the biggest problem. And, you know, for many of our students, they haven't had a math course in 5, 10, 20 years. And, you know, if you don't use it, you lose it. And for many of them, that's a real hurdle to ultimately earning their college degree, because every one of our degrees requires a college-level math course. So you can't avoid it. You've got to raise that skill level and be able to pass the course. It's a shame that too many, that barrier stops them. And we're working very hard to try to find ways to get more and more of those students through those courses, especially through math, because that is, right now, math is the number one course that produces academic failure at PVCC, and I would say at most colleges. Thank you.
From the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.